metabolized in my body now. The rush of action left me, and I started to feel very tired. There's an unavoidable feeling of sympathy for the poor dumb goats that starts to get to me about this stage of the game. Sure, they were better off. Sure, they were going to die if we didn't get them off the plane. But when they saw the other side, they were going to have a hard time believing it. The first ones were returning for a second load, stunned at what they'd just seen. Dozens of people being put into a cubicle that was crowded when it was empty. One college student looked like he'd been hit in the stomach. He stopped by me and his eyes pleaded.
Look, I want to help you people. Just, what's going on? Is this some new kind of rescue? I mean, are we going to crash?
I switched my gun to prod and brushed it across his cheek. He gasped and fell back. Shut your fucking mouth and get moving or I'll kill you. It would be hours before his jaw was in any shape to ask any more stupid questions. We cleared tourist and moved up. A couple of the work gang were pretty damn pooped by then. Muscles like horses, all of them. But they can hardly run up a flight of stairs. We let some of them go through, including a couple that were at least 50 years old. Jesus, 50. We got down to a core of 4 men and 2 women who seemed strong and worked them until they nearly dropped. But we processed everyone in 25 minutes. The port-a-pack came through as we were stripping off our clothes. Christabel knocked on the door to the cockpit and Dave came out, already naked, a bad sign. I had to cork him, he said. Bleeding captain just had to make his grand march through the plane. I tried everything. Sometimes you have to do it. The plane was on autopilot, as it normally would be at this time. But if any of us did anything detrimental to the craft, change the fixed course of events in any way, that would be it. All that work for nothing, and flight 128 inaccessible to us for all time. I don't know sludge about time theory, but I know the practical angles. We can do things in the past only at times and in places where it won't make any difference. We have to cover our tracks. There's flexibility. Once a snatcher left her gun behind, and it went in with the plane, nobody found it, or if they did, they didn't have the smoggiest idea of what it was. So we were okay. Flight 128 was mechanical failure. That's the best kind. It means we don't have to keep the pilot unaware of the situation in the cabin right down to ground level. We can cork him and fly the plane, since there's nothing he could have done to save the flight anyway. A pilot error smash is almost impossible to snatch. We mostly work mid-air, bombs, and structural failures. If there's even one survivor, we can't touch it. It would not fit the fabric of space-time, which is immutable, though it can stretch a little, and we'd all just fade away and appear back in the ready room. My head was hurting. I wanted that port-a-pack very badly.
Who has the most hours on a 707?
Pinky did. So I sent her to the cabin along with Dave, who could do the pilot's voice for air traffic control. You have to have a believable record in the flight recorder, too. They trailed 2 long tubes from the port-a-pack, and the rest of us hooked in up close. We stood there, each of us smoking a fistful of cigarettes, wanting to finish them but hoping there wouldn't be time. The gate had vanished as soon as we tossed our clothes and the flight crew through. But we didn't worry long. There's other nice things about snatching, but nothing to compare with the rush of plugging into a port-a-pack. The wake-up transfusion is nothing but fresh blood, rich in oxygen and sugars. What we were getting now was an insane brew of concentrated adrenaline, supersaturated hemoglobin, methadrine, white lightning, TNT, and Kickapoo joy juice. It was like a firecracker in your heart. Boot in the box that rattled your socks. I'm growing hair on my chest, Christabel said solemnly. Everyone giggled.
Would someone hand me my eyeballs? The blue ones or the red ones? I think my ass just fell off.
We'd heard them all before, but we howled anyway. We were strong, strong. And for one golden moment, we had no worries. Everything was hilarious. I could have torn sheet metal with my eyelashes. But you get hyper on that mix. When the gate didn't show, and didn't show, And didn't Sweet G's show? We all started milling. This bird wasn't going to fly all that much longer. Then it did show, and we turned on. The first of the wimps came through, dressed in the clothes taken from a passenger it had been picked to resemble. 2:35 elapsed upside time, Christabel announced.
Jesus.
It is a deadening routine. You grab the harness around the wimp's shoulders and drag it along the aisle after consulting the seat number painted on its forehead. The paint would last 3 minutes. You seat it, strap it in, break open the harness, and carry it back to toss through the gate as you grab the next one. You have to take it for granted they've done the work right on the other side. Fillings in the teeth, fingerprints, the right match in height and weight and hair color. Most of those things don't matter much, especially on Flight 128, which was a crash and burn. There would be bits and pieces, and burn to a crisp at that. But you can't take chances. Those rescue workers are pretty thorough on the parts they do find. The dental work and fingerprints especially are important. I hate wimps. I really hate them. Every time I grab the harness of one of them, if it's a child, I wonder if it's Alice. Are you my kid? You vegetable, you slug, you slimy worm. I joined the Snatchers right after the brain bugs ate the life out of my baby's head. I couldn't stand to think she was the last generation. That the last humans there would ever live with nothing in their heads, medically dead by standards that prevailed even in 1979, with computers working their muscles to keep them in tone. You grow up, reach puberty still fertile, 1 in 1,000, rush to get pregnant in your first heat. Then you find out your mom or pop passed on a chronic disease bound right into the genes, and none of your kids will be immune. I knew about the paraleprosy. I grew up with my toes rotting away. But this was too much. What do you do? Only 1 in 10 of the wimps had a customized face. It takes time and a lot of skill to build a new face that will stand up to a doctor's autopsy. The rest came pre-mutilated. We've got millions of them. It's not hard to find a good match in the body. Most of them would stay breathing, too dumb to stop, until they went in with the plane. The plane jerked hard. I glanced at my watch. 5 minutes to impact. We should have time. I was on my last wimp. I could hear Dave frantically calling the ground. A bomb came through the gate, and I tossed it into the cockpit. Pinky turned on the pressure sensor on the bomb and came running out, followed by Dave. Liza was already through. I grabbed the limp dolls in Stewardess costume and tossed them to the floor. The engine fell off, and a piece of it came through the cabin. We started to depressurize. The bomb blew away part of the cockpit. The ground crash crew would read it, we hoped, that part of the engine came through and killed the crew. No more words from the pilot on the flight recorder. And we turned slowly left and down. I was lifted toward the hole in the side of the plane, but I managed to hold on to a seat. Christabel wasn't so lucky. She was blown backwards. We started to rise slightly, losing speed. Suddenly, it was uphill from where Christabel was lying in the aisle. Blood oozed from her temple. I glanced back. Everyone was gone, and 3 pink-suited wimps were piled on the floor. The plane began to stall, to nose down, and my feet left the floor. "Come on, Belle!" I screamed. The gate was only 3 feet away from me, but I began pulling myself along to where she floated. The plane bumped, and she hit the floor. Incredibly, it seemed to wake her up. She started to swim toward me, and I grabbed her hand as the floor came up to slam us again. We crawled as the plane went through its final death agony, and we came to the door. The gate was gone. There wasn't anything to say. We were going in. It's hard enough to keep the gate in place on a plane that's moving in a straight line. When a bird gets to corkscrewing and coming apart, the math is fearsome, so I've been told. I embraced Christabel and held her bloodied head. She was groggy, but managed to smile and shrug. You take what you get. I hurried into the restroom and got both of us down on the floor. Back to the forward bulkhead, Christabel between my legs, back to front, just like in training. We pressed our feet against the other wall. I hugged her tightly and cried on her shoulder. And it was there, a green glow to my left. I threw myself toward it, dragging Christabel, keeping low as two wimps were thrown headfirst through the gate above our heads. Hands grabbed and pulled us through. I clawed my way a good 5 yards along the floor. You can leave a leg on the other side, and I didn't have one to spare. I sat up as they were carrying Christabel to medical. I patted her arm as she went by on the stretcher, but she was passed out. I wouldn't have minded passing out myself. For a while, you can't believe it all really happened. Sometimes it turns out it didn't happen. You come back and find out all the goats in the holding pen have softly and suddenly vanished away because the continuum won't tolerate the changes and paradoxes you've put into it. The people you've worked so hard to rescue are spread like tomato surprise all over some goddamn hillside in Carolina, and all you've got left is a bunch of ruined wimps and an exhausted snatch team. But not this time. I could see the goats milling around in the holding pen, naked and more bewildered than ever, and just starting to be really afraid. Elfrieda touched me as I passed her. She nodded, which meant well done in her limited repertoire of gestures. I shrugged, wondering if I cared, but the surplus adrenaline was still in my veins, and I found myself grinning at her. I nodded back. Jean was standing by the holding pen. I went to him, hugged him. I felt the juices start to flow. Damn it, let's squander a little ration and have us a good time. Someone was beating on the sterile glass wall of the pen. She shouted, mouthing angry words at us.
Why? What have you done to us?
It was Mary Sondergaard. She implored her bald, one-legged twin to make her understand. She thought she had problems. God, was she pretty. I hated her guts. Jean pulled me away from the wall. My hands hurt, and I'd broken off all my fake nails without scratching the glass. She was sitting on the floor now, sobbing. I heard the voice of the briefing officer on the outside speaker. Centauri III is hospitable, with an Earth-like climate. By that, I mean your Earth, not what it has become. You'll see more of that later. The trip will take 5 years ship time. Upon landfall, you will be entitled to one horse, a plow, 3 axes, 200 kilos of seed grain. I leaned against Jean's shoulder. At their lowest ebb, this very moment, they were so much better than us. I had maybe 10 years, half of that as a basket case. They are our best, our very brightest hope. Everything is up to them.
That no one will be forced to go. We wish to point out again, not for the last time, that you would all be dead without our intervention. There are things you should know, however. You cannot breathe our air. If you remain on Earth, you can never leave this building. We are not like you. We are the result of a genetic winnowing, a mutation process. We are the survivors, but our enemies have evolved along with us. They are winning. You, however, are immune to the diseases that afflict us.
I winced and turned away.
The other hand, if you emigrate, you will be given a chance at a new life. It won't be easy, but as Americans, you should be proud of your pioneer heritage. Your ancestors survived, and so will you. It can be a rewarding experience, and I urge you.
Sure. Jean and I looked at each other and laughed. Listen to this, folks. 5% of you will suffer nervous breakdowns in the next few days and never leave. About the same number will commit suicide, here and on the way. When you get there, 60-70% will die in the first 3 years. You will die in childbirth, be eaten by animals, bury 2 out of 3 of your babies, starve slowly when the rains don't come. If you live, it will be to break your back behind a plow, sun up to dusk. New Earth is heaven, folks. How I wish I could go with them.
You Are Released by Joe Hill. Joe Hill began his career with a short story called Better Than Home almost 20 years ago and published his first novel, the best-selling Heart-Shaped Box, in 2007. He's written three more highly regarded novels, a book of novellas, Strange Weather, dozens of short stories, many published in 20th Century Ghosts, and the award-winning graphic novel series, Lock and Key. He is the son of your humble editor, who could not be more proud of the relationship. Here, written especially for this collection, is one of his scariest stories. May we all pray it never comes true.
You Are Released. Read by Corey Stoll.
Greg Holder in business. Holder is on his third scotch and playing it cool about the famous woman sitting next to him when all the TVs in the cabin go black and a message in white block text appears on the screens. An announcement is in progress. Static hisses from the public address system. The pilot has a young voice, the voice of an uncertain teenager addressing a crowd at a funeral.
Folks, this is Captain Waters. I've had a message from our team on the ground, and after thinking it over, it seems proper to share it with you. There's been an incident at Anderson Air Force Base in Guam, and...
The PA cuts out. There's a long, suspenseful silence.
I'm told...
Waters continues abruptly.
That U.S. Strategic Command is no longer in contact with our forces there or with the regional governor's office. There are reports from offshore that there was a flash. Some kind of flash.
Holder unconsciously presses himself back into his seat, as if in response to a jolt of turbulence. What the hell does that mean, there was a flash? Flash of what? So many things can flash in this world. A girl can flash a bit of leg. A high roller can flash his money. Lightning flashes. Your whole life can flash before your eyes. Can Guam flash? An entire island? Just say if they were nuked, please, murmurs the famous woman on his left in that well-bred, moneyed, honeyed voice of hers. Captain Waters continues.
I'm sorry I don't know more, and that what I do know is so...
His voice trails off again. Appalling, the famous woman suggests. Disheartening, dismaying, shattering.
Worrisome,
Waters finishes. Fine. The famous woman says with a certain dissatisfaction.
That's all I know right now, Waters says. We'll share more information with you as it comes in. At this time, we're cruising at 37,000 feet, and we're about halfway through your flight. We should arrive in Boston a little ahead of schedule.
There's a scraping sound and a sharp click, and the monitors start playing films again. About half the people in business class are watching the same superhero movie. Captain America, throwing his shield like a steel-edged frisbee, cutting down grotesques that look like they just crawled out from under the bed. A black girl of about 9 or 10 sits across the aisle from Holder. She looks at her mother and says, in a voice that carries,
"Where is Guam, precisely?"
Her use of the word precisely tickles Holder. It's so teacherly and unchildlike. The girl's mother says,
"I don't know, sweetie. I think it's near Hawaii."
She isn't looking at her daughter. She's glancing this way and that with a bewildered expression, as if reading an invisible text for instructions. How to discuss a nuclear exchange with your child. It's closer to Taiwan, Holder says, leaning across the aisle to address the child. Just south of Korea, adds the famous woman. I wonder how many people live there, Holder says. The celebrity arches an eyebrow. You mean as of this moment? Based on the report we just heard, I should think very few. Arnold Feitelman in coach. The violinist Feitelman has an idea the very pretty, very sick-looking teenage girl sitting next to him is Korean. Every time she slips her headphones off to speak to a flight attendant or to listen to the recent announcement, he's heard what sounds like K-pop coming from her Samsung. Feitelman himself was in love with a Korean for several years, a man 10 years his junior, who loved comic books and played a brilliant, if brittle, viol, and who killed himself by stepping in front of a red line train. His name was So, as in So It Goes, or So There We Are, or Little Miss So-and-So, or So What Do I Do Now? So's breath was always sweet, like almond milk, and his eyes were always shy, and it embarrassed him to be happy. Feitelman always thought So was happy, right up to the day he leapt like a ballet dancer into the path of a 52-ton engine. Feitelman wants to offer the girl comfort and at the same time doesn't want to intrude on her anxiety. He mentally wrestles with what to say, if anything, and finally nudges her gently. When she pops out her earbuds, he says, "Do you need something to drink? I've got half a can of Coke that I haven't touched. It isn't germy. I've been drinking from the glass." She shows him a small, frightened smile. "Thank you. My insides are all knotted up." She takes the can and has a swallow. "If your stomach is upset, the fizz will help," he says. "I've always said that on my deathbed, the last thing I want to taste before I leave this world is a cold Coca-Cola." Feitelman has said this exact thing to others many times before, but as soon as it's out of his mouth, he wishes he could have it back. Under the circumstances, it strikes him as a rather infelicitous sentiment. "I've got family there," she says.
"In Guam?"
"In Korea," she says, and shows him the nervous smile again. The pilot never said anything about Korea in his announcement, but anyone who's watched CNN in the last 3 weeks knows that's what this is about. "Which Korea?" says the big man on the other side of the aisle. "The good one or the bad one?" The big man wears an offensively red turtleneck that brings out the color in his honeydew melon of a face. He's so large he overspills the seat. The woman sitting next to him, a small, black-haired lady with the high-strung intensity of an overbred greyhound, has been crowded close to the window. There's an enamel American flag pin in the lapel of his suit coat. Feitelman already knows they could never be friends. The girl gives the big man a startled glance and smooths her dress over her thighs. "South Korea," she says, declining to play his game of good versus bad. "My brother just got married in Jeju. I'm on my way back to school." "Where's school?" Feitelman asks. "MIT.
"I'm surprised you could get in," says the big man. "They've got to draft a certain number of unqualified inner-city kids to meet their quota. That means a lot less space for people like you."
"People like what?" Feitelman asks, enunciating slowly and deliberately. "People like what?" Nearly 50 years of being gay has taught Feitelman that it is a mistake to let certain statements pass unchallenged. The big man is unashamed. "People who are qualified. People who earned it. People who can do the arithmetic. There's a lot more to math than counting out change when someone buys a dime bag. A lot of the model immigrant communities have suffered because of quotas. The Orientals especially." Feitelman laughs, sharp, strained, disbelieving laughter. But the MIT girl closes her eyes and is still, and Feitelman opens his mouth to tell the big son of a bitch off, and then shuts it again. It would be unkind to the girl to make a scene. "It's Guam, not Seoul," Feitelman tells her. "And we don't know what happened there. It might be anything. It might be an explosion at a power station, a normal accident and not a catastrophe of some sort." The first word that occurred to him was Holocaust. "Dirty bomb," says the big man. "Bet you $100. He's upset because we just missed him in Russia." He is the supreme leader of the DPRK. There are rumors someone took a shot at him while he was on a state visit to the Russian side of Lake Khasan, a body of water on the border between the two nations. There are unconfirmed reports that he was hit in the shoulder, hit in the knee. Not hit at all. That a diplomat beside him was hit and killed. That one of the supreme leader's impersonators was killed. According to the internet, the assassin was either a radical anti-Putin anarchist, or a CIA agent masquerading as a member of the Associated Press, or a K-pop star named Extra Value Meal. The U.S. State Department and the North Korean media, in a rare case of agreement, insist there were no shots fired during the Supreme Leader's visit to Russia, no assassination attempt at all. Like many following the story, Feitelman takes this to mean the Supreme Leader came very close to dying indeed. It is also true that 8 days ago, a U.S. submarine patrolling the Sea of Japan shot down a North Korean test missile in North Korean airspace. A DPRK spokesman called it an act of war and promised to retaliate in kind. Well, no. He had promised to fill the mouths of every American with ashes. The Supreme Leader himself didn't say anything. He hasn't been seen since the assassination attempt that didn't happen. "They wouldn't be that stupid," Feitelman says to the big man talking across the Korean girl. "Think about what would happen." The small, wiry, dark-haired woman stares at the big man sitting beside her with a slavish pride, and Feitelman suddenly realizes why she tolerates his paunch intruding on her personal space. They're together. She loves him, perhaps adores him. The big man replies placidly, $100. Leonard Waters in the cockpit. North Dakota is somewhere beneath them, but all Waters can see is a hilly expanse of cloud stretching to the horizon. Waters has never visited North Dakota, and when he tries to visualize it, imagines rusting antique farm equipment, Billy Bob Thornton, and furtive acts of buggery in grain silos. On the radio, the controller in Minneapolis instructs a 737 to ascend to flight level 360 and increase speed to Mach 7-8. "Never been to Guam?" asks his first officer with a false, fragile cheer. Waters has never flown with a female co-pilot before and can hardly bear to look at her. She is so heartbreakingly beautiful. Face like that, she ought to be on magazine covers. Up until the moment he met her in the conference room at LAX, 2 hours before they flew, he didn't know anything about her except her name was Bronson. He had been picturing someone like the guy in the original Death Wish. "Been to Hong Kong," Waters says, wishing she wasn't so terribly lovely. Waters is in his mid-40s and looks about 19, a slim man with red hair cut to a close bristle and a map of freckles on his face. He is only just married and soon to be a father. A photo of his gourd-ripe wife in a sundress has been clipped to the dash. He doesn't want to be attracted to anyone else. He feels ashamed of even spotting a handsome woman. At the same time, he doesn't want to be cold, formal, distant. He's proud of his airline for employing more female pilots, wants to approve, to support. All gorgeous women are an affliction upon his soul. "Sydney, Taiwan, not Guam, though. Me and friends used to free dive off Phi-Phi Beach. Once I got close enough to a black-tipped shark to pet it. Freediving naked is the only thing better than flying." The word naked goes through him like a jolt from a joy buzzer. That's his first reaction. His second reaction is that of course she knows Guam. She's ex-Navy, which is where she learned to fly. When he glances at her sidelong, he's shocked to find tears in her eyelashes. Kate Bronson catches his gaze and gives him a crooked, embarrassed grin that shows the slight gap between her two front teeth. He tries to imagine her with a shaved head and dog tags. It isn't hard. For all her cover girl looks, there is something slightly feral underneath, something wiry and reckless about her. I don't know why I'm crying. I haven't been there in 10 years. It's not like I have any friends there. Waters considers several possible reassuring statements and discards each in turn. There is no kindness in telling her it might not be as bad as she thinks, when in fact, it is likely to be far worse. There's a rap at the door. Bronson hops up, wipes her cheeks with the back of her hand, glances through the peephole, turns the bolts. It's Vorstenbosch, the senior flight attendant, a plump, effete man with wavy blonde hair, a fussy manner, and small eyes behind his thick, gold-framed glasses. He's calm, professional, and pedantic when sober, and a potty-mouthed, swishy delight when drunk. "Did someone nuke Guam?" he asks without preamble. I don't have anything from the ground except we've lost contact, Waters says.
What's that mean, specifically? Vorstenbosch asks. I've got a plane load of very frightened people and nothing to tell them. Bronson thumps her head, ducking behind the controls to sit back down.
Waters pretends not to see. He pretends not to notice her hands are shaking.
It means...
Waters begins, but there's an alert tone, and then the controller is on with a message for everyone in ZMP airspace. The voice from Minnesota is sandy, smooth, untroubled. He might be talking about nothing more important than a region of high pressure. They're taught to sound that way. This is Minneapolis Center with high priority instructions for all aircraft on this frequency. Be advised we have received instructions from U.S. Strategic Command to clear this airspace for operations from Ellsworth. We will begin directing all flights to the closest appropriate airport. Repeat, we are grounding all commercial and recreational aircraft in the ZMP. Please remain alert and ready to respond promptly to our instructions. There is a momentary hiss, and then, with what sounds like real regret, Minneapolis adds, "Sorry about this, ladies and gents. Uncle Sam needs the sky this afternoon for an unscheduled world war."
Ellsworth Airport, Vorstenbosch says.
What do they have at Ellsworth Airport?
The 28th Bomb Wing, Bronson says, rubbing her head.
Veronica Darcy in business. The plane banks deeply and Veronica Darcy looks straight down at the rumpled duvet of cloud beneath. Shafts of blinding sunshine stab through the windows on the other side of the cabin. The good-looking drunk beside her, he has a loose lock of dark hair on his brow that makes her think of Cary Grant, of Clark Kent, unconsciously squeezes his armrests. She wonders if he's a white-knuckle flyer or just a boozer. He had his first scotch as soon as they reached cruising altitude, 3 hours ago, just after 10 a.m. The screens go black, and another announcement is in progress. Veronica shuts her eyes to listen, focusing the way she might at a table read as another actor reads lines for the first time.
Captain Waters, VO.
Hello, passengers. Captain Waters again. I'm afraid we've had an unexpected request from air traffic control to reroute to Fargo and put down at Hector International Airport. We've been asked to clear this airspace effective immediately.
Uneasy beat.
For military maneuvers. Obviously, the situation in Guam has created, complications for everyone in the sky today. There's no reason for alarm, but we're gonna have to put down. We expect to be on the ground in Fargo in 40 minutes. I'll have more information for you as it comes in.
Beat.
My apologies, folks. This isn't the afternoon any of us was hoping for.
If it were a movie, the captain wouldn't sound like a teenage boy going through the worst of adolescence. They would have cast someone gruff and authoritative. Hugh Jackman, maybe, or a Brit if they wanted to suggest erudition, a hint of Oxford-acquired wisdom. Derek Jacobi, perhaps. Veronica has acted alongside Derek off and on for almost 30 years. He held her backstage the night her mother died, and talked her through it in a gentle, reassuring murmur. An hour later, they were both dressed as Romans in front of 480 people, and God was he good that night. And she was good, too. And that was the evening she learned she could act her way through anything. And she can act her way through this, too. Inside, she is already growing calmer, letting go of all cares, all concern. It has been years since she felt anything she didn't decide to feel first.
"I thought you were drinking too early," she says to the man beside her.
"It turns out I started drinking too late." She lifts the little plastic cup of wine she was served with her lunch and says, "Chin chin," before draining it. He turns a lovely, easy smile upon her.
"I've never been to Fargo, although I did watch the TV show." He narrows his eyes. "Were you in Fargo? I feel like you were. You did something with forensics, and then Ewan McGregor strangled you to death?"
"No, darling, you're thinking of contract murder, and it was James McAvoy with a garrote."
"So it was. I knew I saw you die once.
Do you die a lot?
Oh, all the time. I did a picture with Richard Harris. It took him all day to bludgeon me to death with a candlestick. 5 setups, 40 takes. Poor man was exhausted by the end of it. Her seatmate's eyes bulge, and she knows he's seen the picture and remembers her role. She was 22 at the time and naked in every scene, no exaggeration. Veronica's daughter once asked, "Mom, when exactly did you discover clothing?" Veronica had replied, "Right after you were born, darling." Veronica's daughter is beautiful enough to be in movies herself, but she makes hats instead. When Veronica thinks of her, her chest aches with pleasure. She never deserved to have such a sane, happy, grounded daughter. When Veronica considers herself, when she reckons with her own selfishness and narcissism, her indifference to mothering, her preoccupation with her career, it seems impossible that she should have such a good person in her life. "I'm Greg," says her neighbor, Greg Holder. "Veronica Darcy. What brought you to L.A.? Apart, or do you live there?" "I had to be there for the apocalypse. I play a wise old woman of the wasteland. I assume it will be a wasteland. All I saw was a green screen. I hope the real apocalypse will hold off long enough for the film to come out. Do you think it will?" Greg looks out at the landscape of cloud. "Sure, it's North Korea, not China. What can they hit us with? No apocalypse for us. For them, maybe." "How many people live in North Korea?" This from the girl on the other side of the aisle, the one with the comically huge glasses. She has been listening to them intently and is leaning toward them now in a very adult way. Her mother gives Greg and Veronica a tight smile and pats her daughter's arm. "Don't disturb the other passengers, dear." "She's not disturbing me," Greg says. "I don't know, kid, but a lot of them live on farms scattered across the countryside. There's only the one big city, I think. Whatever happens, I'm sure most of them will be okay." The girl sits back and considers this, then twists in her seat to whisper to her mother. Her mother squeezes her eyes shut and shakes her head. Veronica wonders if she even knows she is still patting her daughter's arm. "I have a girl about her age," Greg says. "I have a girl about your age," Veronica tells him. "She's my favorite thing in the world." "Yep, me too. My daughter, I mean, not yours. I'm sure yours was great as well." "Are you headed home to her?" "Yes, my wife called to ask if I would cut a business trip short. My wife is in love with a man she met on Facebook, and she wants me to come take care of the kids so she can drive up to Toronto to meet him." "Oh my God, you're not serious. Did you have any warning?" "I thought she was spending too much time online, but to be fair, she thought I was spending too much time being drunk. I guess I'm an alcoholic. I guess I might have to do something about that now. I think I'll start by finishing this." And he swallows the last of his scotch. Veronica has been divorced twice and has always been keenly aware that she herself was the primary agent of domestic ruin. When she thinks about how badly she behaved, how badly she used Robert and Francois, she feels ashamed and angry at herself, and so she is naturally glad to offer sympathy and solidarity to the wronged man beside her. Any opportunity to atone, no matter how small. "I'm so sorry. What a terrible bomb to have dropped on you."
"What did you say?"
asked the girl across the aisle, leaning toward them again. The deep brown eyes behind those glasses never seemed to blink.
"Are we going to drop a nuclear bomb on them?"
She sounds more curious than afraid, but at this, her mother exhales a sharp, panicked breath. Greg leans toward the child again, smiling in a way that is both kindly and wry, and Veronica suddenly wishes she were 20 years younger. She might have been good for a fellow like him.
"I don't know what the military options are, so I couldn't say for sure, but..."
Before he can finish, the cabin fills with a nerve-shredding sonic howl. An airplane slashes past, then two more flying in tandem.
One is so near off the port wing that Veronica catches a glimpse of the man in the cockpit, helmeted, face cupped in some kind of breathing apparatus. These aircraft bear scant resemblance to the 777 carrying them east. These are immense iron falcons, the gray hue of bullet tips, of lead. The force of their passing causes the whole airliner to shudder. Passengers scream, grab each other. The punishing sound of the bombers crossing their path can be felt intestinally, in the bowels. Then they're gone, having raked long contrails across the bright blue. A shocked, shaken silence follows. Veronica Darcy looks at Greg Holder and sees he has smashed his plastic cup, made a fist, and broken it into flinders. He notices what he's done at the same time and laughs and puts the wreckage on the armrest. Then he turns back to the little girl and finishes his sentence as if there had been no interruption. But I'd say all signs point to yes. Jenny Slate in coach. B-1s, her love says to her in a relaxed, almost pleased tone of voice. Lancers. They used to carry a fully nuclear payload, but Black Jesus did away with them. There's still enough firepower on board to cook every dog in Pyongyang, which is funny because usually if you want cooked dog in North Korea, you have to make reservations. They should have risen up, Jenny says. Why didn't they rise up when they had a chance? Did they want work camps? Did they want to starve? That's the difference between the Western mindset and the Oriental worldview, Bobby says. There, individualism is viewed as aberrant. In a murmur, he adds, there's a certain ant colony quality to their thinking. Excuse me, says the Jew in the middle aisle, sitting next to the Oriental girl. He couldn't be any more Jewish if he had the beard and his hair in ringlets and the prayer shawl over his shoulders. Could you lower your voice, please? My seatmate is upset. Bobby had lowered his voice, but even when he's trying to be quiet, he has a tendency to boom. This wouldn't be the first time it got them in trouble. Bobby says, she shouldn't be. Come tomorrow morning, South Korea will finally be able to stop worrying about the psychopaths on the other side of the DMZ. Families will be reunited. Well, some families. Cookie-cutter bombs don't discriminate between military and civilian populations. Bobby speaks with the casual certainty of a man who has spent 20 years producing news segments for a broadcasting company that owns something like 70 local TV stations and specializes in distributing content free of mainstream media bias. He's been to Iraq, to Afghanistan. He went to Liberia during the Ebola outbreak to do a piece investigating an ISIS plot to weaponize the virus. Nothing scares Bobby. Nothing rattles him. Jenny was an unwed pregnant mother who had been cast out by her parents and sleeping in the supply room of a gas station between shifts on the day Bobby brought her an extra value meal and told her he didn't care who the father was. He said he would love the baby as much as if it were his own. Jenny had already scheduled the abortion. Bobby told her calmly, quietly, that if she came with him, he would give her and the child a good, happy life. But if she drove to the clinic, she would murder a child and lose her own soul. She had gone with him, and it had been just as he said, all of it. He had loved her well, had adored her from the first. He was her miracle. She did not need the loaves and the fishes to believe. Bobby was enough. Jenny fantasized sometimes that a liberal, a code pinker, maybe, or one of the Bernie people, would try to assassinate him, and she would manage to step between Bobby and the gun to take the bullet herself. She had always wanted to die for him, to kiss him with the taste of her own blood in her mouth. I wish we had phones, the pretty Oriental girl says suddenly. Some of these planes have phones. I wish there was a way to call someone. How long before the bombers get there? Even if we could make calls from this aircraft, Bobby says, it would be hard to get a call through. One of the first things the U.S. will do is wipe out communications in the region, and they might not limit themselves to just the DPRK. They won't want to risk agents in the South, a sleeper government, coordinating a counterstrike.
Plus, everyone with family in the Korean Peninsula will be calling right now. It'll be like trying to call Manhattan on 9/11. Only this time it's their turn.
Their turn? Says the Jew. Their turn?
I must have missed the report that said North Korea was responsible for bringing down the World Trade Towers. I thought that was Al-Qaeda. North Korea sold them weapons and intel for years, Bobby lets him know. It's all connected. North Korea has been the number one exporter of Destroy America fever for decades. Jenny butts her shoulder against Bobby and says, or they used to be. I think they've been replaced by the Black Lives Matter people. She is actually repeating something Bobby said to friends only a few nights before. She thought it was a witty line, and she knows he likes hearing his own best material repeated back to him.
Wow. Wow, says the Jew. That's the most racist thing I've ever heard in real life. If millions of people are about to die, it's because millions of people like you put unqualified, hate-filled morons in charge of our government.
The girl closes her eyes and sits back in her chair.
My wife is what kind of people? Bobby asks, lifting one eyebrow.
Bobby, Jenny cautions him, I'm fine. I'm not bothered. I didn't ask if you were bothered. I asked this gentleman what kind of people he thinks he's talking about.
The Jew has hectic red blotches on his cheek. People who are cruel, smug, and ignorant.
He turns away, trembling.
Bobby kisses his wife's temple and then unbuckles his seatbelt.
Mark Vorstenbosch in the cockpit. Vorstenbosch is 10 minutes calming people down in coach, and another 5 wiping beer off Arnold Feitelman's head and helping him change his sweater. He tells Feitelman and Robert Slate that if he sees either one of them out of their seats again before they land, they will both be arrested in the airport. The man Slate accepts this placidly, tightening his seatbelt and placing his hands in his lap, staring serenely forward. Feitelman looks like he wants to protest. Feitelman is shaking helplessly, and his color is bad, and he calms down only when Vorstenbosch tucks a blanket in around his legs. As he's leaning toward Feitelman's seat, Vorstenbosch whispers that when the plane lands, they'll make a report together, and that Slate will be written up for verbal and physical assault. Feitelman gives him a glance of surprise and appreciation, one gay to another, looking out for each other in a world full of Robert Slates. The senior flight attendant himself feels nauseated and steps into the head long enough to steady himself. The cabin smells of vomit and fear fore and aft. Children weep inconsolably. Vorstenbosch has seen 2 women praying. He touches his hair, washes his hands, draws one deep breath after another. Vorstenbosch's role model has always been the Anthony Hopkins character from The Remains of the Day, a film he has never seen as a tragedy, but rather as an encomium to a life of disciplined service. Vorstenbosch sometimes wishes he was British. He recognized Veronica Darcy in Business right away, but his professionalism requires him to resist acknowledging her celebrity in any overt way. When he has composed himself, he exits the head and begins making his way to the cockpit to tell Captain Waters they will require airport security upon landing. He pauses in Business to tend to a woman who is hyperventilating. When Vorstenbosch takes her hand, he is reminded of the last time he held his grandmother's hand. At the time, she was in her coffin, and her fingers were just as cold and lifeless. Vorstenbosch feels a quavering indignation when he thinks about the bombers, those idiotic hot dogs blasting by so close to the plane. The lack of simple human consideration sickens him. He practices deep breathing with the woman, assures her they'll be on the ground soon. The cockpit is filled with sunshine and calm. He isn't surprised. Everything about the work is designed to make even a crisis, and this is a crisis, albeit one they never practiced in the flight simulators, a matter of routine, of checklists and proper procedure. The first officer is a scamp of a girl who brought a brown bag lunch onto the plane with her. When her left sleeve was hiked up, Vorstenbosch glimpsed part of a tattoo, a white lion, just above the wrist. He looks at her and sees in her past a trailer park, a brother hooked on opioids, divorced parents, a first job in Walmart, a desperate escape to the military. He likes her immensely. How can he not? His own childhood was much the same, only instead of escaping to the army, he went to New York to be queer. When she let him into the cockpit last time, she was trying to hide tears, a fact that twists Vorstenbosch's heart. Nothing distresses him quite like the distress of others. "What's happening?" Vorstenbosch asks. "On the ground in 10," says Bronson.
"Maybe," Waters says. "They've got half a dozen planes stacked up ahead of us."
"Any word from the other side of the world?" Vorstenbosch wants to know. For a moment, neither replies. Then, in a stilted, distracted voice, Waters says,
"The U.S. Geological Survey reports a seismic event in Guam that registered about 6.3 on the Richter scale."
"That would correspond to 250 kilotons, Bronson says.
"It was a warhead," Vorstenbosch says. "It's not quite a question."
"Something happened in Pyongyang, too," Bronson says. "An hour before Guam, state television switched over to color bars. There's intelligence about a whole bunch of high-ranking officials being killed within minutes of one another. So we're either talking a palace coup, or we tried to bring down the leadership with some surgical assassinations, and they didn't take it too well." "What can we do for you, Vorstenbosch?" says Waters. "There was a fight in Coach. One man poured beer on another."
"Oh, for fuck's sake," Waters says.
"They've been warned, but we might want Fargo PD on hand when we put down. I believe the victim is going to want to file charges."
"I'll radio Fargo, but no promises. I get the feeling the airport is going to be a madhouse. Security might have their hands full."
"There's also a woman in business having a panic attack. She's trying not to scare her daughter, but she's having trouble breathing. I have her huffing into an air sickness bag, but I'd like emergency services to meet her with an oxygen tank when we get down."
"Done. Anything else?"
"There are a dozen other mini-crises unfolding, but the team has it in hand." "There is one other thing, I suppose. Would either of you like a glass of beer or wine in violation of all regulations?" They glance back at him. Bronson grins. "I want to have your baby, Vorstenbosch," she says. "We would make a lovely child."
Waters says, "Ditto." "That's a yes?"
Waters and Bronson look at each other. "Better not," Bronson decides, and Waters nods. Then the captain adds, "But I'll have the coldest Dos Equis you can find as soon as we're parked." "You know what my favorite thing about flying is?" Bronson asks. "It's always a sunny day up this high. It seems impossible anything so awful could be happening on such a sunny day." They are all admiring the cloudscape when the white and fluffy floor beneath them is lanced through 100 times. 100 pillars of white smoke thrust themselves into the sky, rising from all around. It's like a magic trick, as if the clouds had hidden quills that had suddenly erupted up and out. A moment later, the thunderclap hits them, and with it turbulence, and the plane is kicked, knocked up and to one side. A dozen red lights stammer on the dash. Alarms shriek. Vorstenbosch sees it all in an instant as he's lifted off his feet. For a moment, Vorstenbosch floats, suspended like a parachute, a man made of silk filled with air. His head clubs the wall. He drops so hard and fast, it's as if a trapdoor had opened in the floor of the cockpit and plunged him into the bright fathoms of the sky beneath. Janice Mumford in business.
"Mom!" Janice shouts. "Mom, look at! What's that?"
What's happening in the sky is less alarming than what's happening in the cabin. Someone is screaming, a bright silver thread of sound that stitches itself right through Janice's head. Adults groan in a way that makes Janice think of ghosts. The 777 tilts to the left and then rocks suddenly hard to the right. The plane sails through a labyrinth of gargantuan pillars, the cloisters of some impossibly huge cathedral. Janice had to spell cloisters, an easy one, in the Englewood Regional. Her mother, Millie, doesn't reply. She's breathing steadily into a white paper bag. Millie has never flown before, has never been out of California. Neither has Janice, but unlike her mother, she was looking forward to both. Janice has always wanted to go up in a big airplane. She'd also like to dive in a submarine someday,
although she'd settle for a ride in a glass-bottom kayak. The orchestra of despair and horror sinks away to a soft diminuendo. Janice spelled diminuendo in the first round of the state finals and came this close to blowing it and absorbing a humiliating early defeat. Janice leans toward the nice-looking man who has been drinking iced tea the whole trip. "Were those rockets?" Janice asks. The woman from the movies replies, speaking in her adorable British accent. Janice has only ever heard British accents in films, and she loves them.
"ICBMs," says the movie star. "They're on their way to the other side of the world."
Janice notices the movie star is holding hands with the much younger man who drank all the iced tea. Her features are set in an expression of almost icy calm. The man beside her, on the other hand, looks like he wants to throw up. He's squeezing the older woman's hand so hard his knuckles are white. "Are you two related?" Janice asks. She can't think of why else they might be holding hands. "No," says the nice-looking man. "Then why are you holding hands?"
"Because we're scared," says the movie star, although she doesn't look scared. "And it makes us feel better."
"Oh," Janice says, and then quickly takes her mother's free hand. Her mother looks at her gratefully over the bag that keeps inflating and deflating like a paper lung. Janice glances back at the nice-looking man. "Would you like to hold my hand?"
"Yes, please," the man says, and they take each other's hand across the aisle.
"What's ICBM stand for?"
"Intercontinental Ballistic Missile," the man says.
"That's one of my words. I had to spell intercontinental in the regional."
"For real? I don't think I can spell intercontinental off the top of my head."
"Oh, it's easy," Janice says, and proves it by spelling it for him.
"I'll take your word for it. You're the expert."
"I'm going to Boston for a spelling bee. It's international semifinals, and if I do well there, I get to go to Washington, D.C. and be on television. I didn't think I'd ever go to either of those places. But then I didn't think I'd ever go to Fargo, either. Are we still landing in Fargo?"
"I don't know what else we'd do," says the nice-looking man.
"How many ICBMs was that?" Janice asks, craning her neck to look at the towers of smoke.
"All of them," says the movie star.
Janice says, "I wonder if we're going to miss the spelling bee." This time it is her mother who responds. Her voice is hoarse, as if she has a sore throat or has been crying.
"I'm afraid we might, sweetie."
"Oh," Janice says, "oh no." She feels a little like she did when they had Secret Santa last year, and she was the only one who didn't get a gift because her Secret Santa was Martin Cohassy and Martin was out with mononucleosis.
"You would have won," her mother says and shuts her eyes, "and not just the semifinals either."
"They aren't till tomorrow night," Janice says. "Maybe we could get on another plane in the morning."
"I'm not sure anyone will be flying tomorrow morning," says the nice-looking man apologetically.
"Because of something that happened in North Korea?"
"No," her friend across the aisle says, "not because of something that's going to happen there." Millie opens her eyes and says,
"Shh, you'll scare her."
But Janice isn't scared. She just doesn't understand. The man across the aisle swings her hand back and forth, back and forth.
"What's the hardest word you ever spelled?" he asks.
"Anthropocene," Janice says promptly. "That's the word I lost on last year at semis. I thought it had an I in it. It means in the era of human beings, as in, the Anthropocene era looks very short when compared to other geological periods." The man stares at her for a moment, then barks with laughter.
"You said it, kid."
The movie star stares out her window at the enormous white columns.
"No one has ever seen a sky like this, these towers of cloud. The bright, sprawling day caged in its bars of smoke. They look like they're holding up heaven. What a lovely afternoon. You might soon get to see me perform another death, Mr. Holder. I'm not sure I can promise to play the part with my usual flair." She shuts her eyes. "I miss my daughter. I don't think I'm going to get to..." She opens her eyes and looks at Janice and falls quiet.
"I've been thinking the same thing about mine," says Mr. Holder. Then he turns his head and peers past Janice at her mother. "Do you know how lucky you are?"
He glances from Millie to Janice and back. And when Janice looks, her mother is nodding, a small gesture of acknowledgement.
Why are you lucky, Mom? Janice asks her.
Millie squeezes her and kisses her temple.
Because we're together today, silly bean.
Oh, Janice says.
It's hard to see the luck in that. They're together every day.
At some point, Janice realizes the nice-looking man has let go of her hand, and when she next looks over, he is holding the movie star in his arms, and she is holding him. And they are kissing each other quite tenderly, and Janice is shocked, just shocked, because the movie star is a lot older than her seatmate. They're kissing just like lovers at the end of the film, right before the credits roll and everyone has to go home. It's so outrageous, Janice just has to laugh.
Ara Lee in Coach.
For a moment at her brother's wedding in Jeju, Ara thought she saw her father, who had been dead for 7 years. The ceremony and reception were held in a vast and lovely private garden, bisected by a deep, cool, man-made river. Children threw handfuls of pellets into the current and watched the water boil with rainbow carp, the 100 heaving, brilliant fish in all the colors of treasure. Rose, gold, and platinum, and new minted copper. Ara's gaze drifted from the kids to the ornamental stone bridge crossing the brook. And there was her father in one of his cheap suits, leaning on the wall, grinning at her. His big, homely face seamed with deep lines. The sight of him startled her so badly that she had to look away, was briefly breathless with shock. When she looked back, he was gone. By the time she was in her seat for the ceremony, she had concluded that she had only seen Jum, her father's younger brother, who cut his hair the same way. It would be easy on such an emotional day to momentarily confuse one for another, especially given her decision not to wear her glasses to the wedding. On the ground, the student of evolutionary linguistics at MIT places her faith in what can be proved, recorded, known, and studied. But now she is aloft and feeling more open-minded. The 777, all 300-odd tons of it, hurtles through the sky, lifted by immense unseen forces. Nothing carries everything on its back. So it is with the dead and the living, the past and the present. Now is a wing, and history is beneath it, holding it up. Ara's father loved fun. He ran a novelty factory for 40 years. Fun was his actual business. Here in the sky, she is willing to believe he would not have let death get between him and such a happy evening.
I'm so fucking scared right now, Arnold Feitelman says. She nods. She is too. I'm so fucking angry. So fucking angry.
She stops nodding. She isn't and chooses not to be. In this moment, more than any other, she chooses not to be. Feitelman says, that motherfucker, Mr. Make America, so fucking great over there. I wish we could bring back the stocks just for one day, so people could hurl dirt and cabbages at him. Do you think this would be happening if Obama was in office? Any of this? This lunacy? Listen, when we get down, if we get down,